Thank you for attending session 372. We'll be richly rewarded. This will be one of the best ones of them all. It's entitled Millennial Mormons Pointing the Way to Change in the LDS Church. Welcome to the closing evening session for Saturday. Following this session, there will be a linger longer picnic with music by the Angela Sof Band. Following the music, there will be evening storytelling with Robert Kirby, Gina Colvin, and Courtney Clark Kendrick. Tickets are limited but available for purchase at the registration desk. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please silence your cell phones and remain respectful. As you leave us tonight, we want to thank you for coming and being part of the Sunstone Symposium. You have now participated in a tradition of Mormon history that is over 40 years old. Mormonism can be what we make it, and your participation helps make Mormonism a little more diverse, interesting, and inclusive. Regardless of your relationship with the Restoration, we claim you as an important part of this community. You are wanted. Your voice is needed. You claiming the identity in your own way is an act of resistance against hate, division, and intolerance. Thank you for having the courage to show up and engage at Sunstone. Please support Sunstone by making a donation, subscribing to the magazine, and by attending our regional conference. You are invited to attend our next regional conference in Glasgow, Scotland, on September 1. Register at sunstone.org. The session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework so that folks can get out for dinner on time. About this presentation, millennials are more likely than older Mormons to support LGBT rights, drink a little coffee now and then, and say they're bothered by women not holding the priesthood. Most are also strong believers with the highest missionary service rates of any generation and a deep commitment to serving their neighbors. Reese has gathered all this data into the book, The Next Mormons. She will present some of her data in this session, while two of the millennials she interviewed respond to the chapters that feature their stories, offering their observations about gender identity, missionary service, and why so many people are leaving the church. Jana Reese, immediately to my right, is a senior columnist for Religion News Service, where she writes about Mormonism, politics, popular culture, and spirituality. She has a PhD in American Religious History from Columbia University, and is the author of numerous books, including The Next Mormons, Millennials and the Future of the LDS Church. She is a Ward Relief Society teacher and Stake Self-Reliance facilitator. Annabelle Jensen is at the far right of me. Is an LDS transgender woman who has spent her adult life trying to bring about lasting change in her community through service, awareness, and activism, with a focus on keeping families together. In 2015, at age 26, she was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Gloria Pak, in the middle, is a first-generation Korean-American and freelance graphic designer and illustrator based in Salt Lake City. She is also the creative director of the Lower Lights School of Wisdom. She lives with her husband and collaborator, Thomas McConkie, and their pup, Luna. And now for the presentation.
Thank you all for coming. We are acutely aware that we are the only thing standing between you and your dinner. So it's possible that we may be able to end a little bit sooner. We'll see how it is with Q&A. The way we have structured this is that I'm going to give a few introductory remarks here at the beginning, and then give a few slides about the project as a whole, and a few slides about the chapter that Gloria is responding to, which is the missionary chapter. And then Gloria will speak. And then I'll give three slides about the gender chapter, which Annabelle is going to respond to, and then Annabelle will speak, and then we will have, I hope, a nice, healthy amount of time for Q&A. I did, in this presentation, put in a lot of slides at the bottom that I'm not going to get into in the presentation, but if those issues come up in the Q&A, like if you want to know about coffee, or if you want to know about a whole bunch of other things, you know, how many people are single in the church and lots of other things, I might have a slide related to your question. We'll see. So every time I have spoken about this research, I want to have at least one slide on methodology and have it not be too overwhelming. But the next Mormon study is from 2016, and it's a nationally representative survey of Mormons and former Mormons. We had 1,156 currently identified Mormons. These are people who choose LDS or Mormon on a survey. And we had 540 who had been involved in the church for at least a year as members, but said they are no longer LDS. So a total of almost 1,700 respondents. So when you're looking at the data, be mindful that the margin of error for the current Mormon population is about plus or minus 3% when we're talking about the whole group, and that margin of error is going to go up when we're breaking it down into generations or we're breaking it down by gender. Also, the former Mormon data, the margin of error is about plus or minus 4%. So this project was funded entirely by donations, and I should say the book is forthcoming in March from Oxford University Press, and my copy edits were due yesterday. They're not done yet. Still working on that. But if you donated money 2 years ago to the Kickstarter project, or if you were one of the people who donated afterwards, could you please stand up and give us a chance to say thank you? I know that there are at least a few of you here in the room. Thank you. All of the research that you're about to see is thanks to them. I mean, obviously, I worked hard on it, but it would not have been possible without their donations. And also the contributions of Benjamin Knoll, who is a political scientist at Center College. And Ben did not write the book. I wrote the book, and I did all of the interviews. But Ben was very instrumental in getting this project off the ground and helping to analyze the data, providing the methodologies that were appropriate and IRB approved. So everyone say thank you, Ben. He's also, like as we speak, working on the website for the book, all as a volunteer. He just believes in this a lot. He's also a millennial himself. So when we talk about these generations, just to give you a bit of a clue, we have a silent generation token person here who's on a landline. So silent generation here is defined as being born in 1928 to 1944. So these are people who were not old enough to fight in World War II, but old enough typically to remember it. Baby boomers, 1945 to 1964. Gen X, 65 to 79. I chose that particular photograph because she looked so harried, you know? And then the very well put together millennial, born 1980 to 1998. These categories of the year-to-year cutoffs for generational research are a little bit fluid, and you may find if you are, for example, at the tail end of the baby boomers that you have more in common with the Gen Xers. If you're at the, you know, vanguard of one generation, you may have more in common with the generation preceding you. But in general, there are certain traits that tend to coalesce for each generation. So we had very few silent generation respondents in the survey, and partly this is because when research is conducted online, it's harder to get older people to be part of those panels. And so we only had 36 members of the silent generation among the currently identified Mormons. And the joke is that, you know, it's really never a problem to get old men to weigh in about their opinions in Mormonism. But we had a problem with that. We did not have enough elderly men. So we combined the results of the silent generation with the baby boomers, because we had more than 300 there. And if we put them together, we can have a really robust generational sample size. Gen X, 407 respondents, and 406 millennials. No problem at all to get millennials. And just to say, this is not a snowball survey. This is not the kind of thing that you get an invitation to on social media and then you go and take it, or maybe it's called an affinity survey. This is a nationally representative sample, meaning it's expensive. It's very hard to find these people. And we canvassed more than 23,000 people in order to get the responses that we had. And even those 23,000 were chosen out of a much broader pool of hundreds of thousands of people who have taken surveys in the past and ever indicated their religious affiliation. All right, so just a few things about the missionary service. So Gloria and I were talking about this just beforehand, and she made the comment that it was surprising to see how positive and powerful the data is about millennials in the missionary chapter. And I said, it's kind of downhill from there as the book is structured. This comes fairly early on, and it's a lot of great news at the beginning of the book in terms of how engaged millennials are in the church. So here we have missionary service by generation and by gender. You can see for men in green, 49% this is of the currently identified population, served a mission, 53% of Gen X. Then we have this spike to 2/3 of millennial men serving a mission. For women, it's even more dramatic. So you're going from 13% of boomer silent women who served a mission, doubling that for Gen X at 28%, and then going up to 44.5%. And among younger millennials, it's even higher. So we're starting to see more gender parity in missionary service. And we also found that most of the people who have served a mission regard it as a very positive experience, or at least a somewhat positive experience, in five areas that we asked them about. So was it helpful to you in growing your faith? Was it helpful for you in preparing for a career, gaining converts for the LDS church, preparing for marriage and a family, and appreciating diversity? And in red here are the current Mormons reflecting back on what their mission was like, and in green are the former Mormons. And it was interesting to me and a bit surprising to see how positive the former Mormon assessment was of their missionary experience. So in every case, at least 2/3 said it was either a very or somewhat positive experience. Particularly, appreciating diversity was high in both the current and former Mormons. All right, and then finally, a bit less positive perhaps, is the rise in early return missionaries. Maybe anecdotally you might have noticed this. It seems like more people are talking about early return missions. And we have statistics to show you that it is actually happening. So in our survey, we did not have any silent generation members or baby boomers who returned early from a mission. 5.5% of the Gen X respondents had done so, and then 17% of the millennials, which was a very interesting finding. We had basically 1 in 20 Gen Xers who tried serving a mission but came home early, and then almost 1 in 5 millennials. And that's not just those who served, that's of the entire generation. So that was an interesting finding. So before Gloria speaks, I just want to talk a little bit about the interviews. The interviewees were not part of the sample. They're not in the data. This was separate. And while we made every effort in the data to be nationally representative, and the data was weighted to Pew data so that it would be even more representative, the interviews were just me finding people and people telling me, oh, I know someone who has a really interesting story or experience who might want to talk to you about it. And there was a certain amount of kismet and grace, I think, in finding people to interview, which made this part of the project my favorite part of the project. I wound up interviewing 63 people for between 90 minutes to 2 hours apiece. Most of them happened over the phone. Both of these were actually in-person interviews, and that was particularly cool and special. So we have 340,000 words of these interview transcripts 750 single-spaced pages of interview transcripts. As you can imagine, in the book, only a fraction of those experiences are in the book. So hopefully today we'll hear a little bit more fleshing out. But to me, the greatest privilege of doing this research has been being able to sit down with young people, young adults, and have them tell me about their lives. Sometimes very positive, sanguine experiences, and sometimes very hard, difficult, painful experiences, a real mix. And to be trusted with that, to be stewards of their stories and have them give me permission to tell their stories. Most of the interviewees are identified only by their first names in the book. Some of them chose a different first name. For example, if they have had issues with the church that they don't want their family to find out about and possibly recognize them in the book, they might have chosen a different first name. We also had three people named Natalie. I mean, what are the chances? So I made two of them choose a different name, so just so we would not get everybody confused with one another. But let's listen to Gloria's experiences, and she's going to be focusing particularly on mission work.
Hello. I just want to first thank Jana for all the hard work and heart that she's put into this project. It means a lot to me to have her care so much about the upcoming generation and just the intention for us as a culture and as a church to continue to listen to the following generations. I hopefully, as I get older, want to have that same intention. Regarding my experience, it's largely, you know, my focus group of one. But given reading over Jana's experience, I really resonate with the trajectory of the findings of her book in that when I served my mission in South Korea, Seoul, from 2006 to 2008, I was 21 and your standard mission age. And it was a time in my life where developmentally this was what I needed to pour my heart into my tribe and to give everything I could to the church, and it was everything to me. And so with all the zeal I could muster, I, as an introvert, I'm like, I'm gonna do it. And I found myself in Korea and ready to serve the Lord with all my heart and mind. And it was interesting in that not only was it one of the most transformative and powerful experiences I had, as many of you have experienced for yourself, it was also one of the most darkest times in my life. And the shadow and the light that I experienced on my mission was really profound. And I think it does relate to maybe what comes up later in not only my life, but in the trajectory of millennials as sort of, I don't want to say things go downhill, but things get more nuanced and complex from that that idealized state where you're all in. That said, for me, I when I went into my mission experience, I was 100% about the rules and very much willing to show the Lord how much I loved him by obeying the rules. And that was actually the message that was often given to by the system and the leaders. I remember the message being, if you love the Lord, 100% obedience. Another being, if you're not happy, you're doing something wrong. And all these things where I would set myself up to really show how much I cared about the gospel and about the church and the Lord. And it created a crisis for me because as I did this, I found that reality set in and the nuances of life really broke me open. My companions were struggling just like I was, but in different ways, and it prevented me from leaving the house sometimes because one dealt with a lot of anxiety, and as my paradigm of success was broken, like it became this paradox of, do I love my companion by meeting her needs or following the rules, like getting out of the house, making the stats, doing all that stuff? It really created this internal friction in me where those worldviews couldn't coexist. And I ironically say that the mission was the beginning of my faith crisis. It planted the seed where maybe it would have taken me another 10 to 20 years to outwear the rule-oriented stage of my life. But because it was such a pressure cooker in that environment, it became really obvious really quickly that the rule-oriented stage in the nuances of and the complexities of the relationship couldn't withstand all the situations and the exceptions. And so at one point, my companion, she, out of desperation, called her sister in America, and that was against the rules. And me being, once again, trying to obey, I gave a look of disapproval, or must have shown somehow, because she looked at me, and this was sort of like the time where everything shifted and sort of my world fell apart, where she looked at me and she said, "Sister Pak, it is not about the rules, it is about the people." And I still get really tender about that because I knew it was true. Yet I didn't know how to reconcile the spirit of the law and the letter of the law, because that was the only way I knew how to show my love at that time. But so I like to say that the mission broke me open, and after I came home, I was really confused at how much more confused I was about the gospel than I was when I began my mission. And I felt so burnt out that I could barely get myself to sit at church and do any of the things I was supposed to do anymore. But over time, I think what felt like darkness was a transition into a different way of seeing the world, and different way of translating the gospel, and God, and all of that. What I feel I wanted to share about my anecdotal experience is how much my particular experience in my mission is I found to be a pattern that's in our system. Like, as much as I would like to think I was the only one sometimes who went through some of those experiences, after talking to other people in missions and sisters who were super happy on their missions and then dropped off the planet, and I called them and they were like, "Sister Pak, I don't know what happened on my mission. I don't even talk about it. I just forgot it." And there's so much silence around some of the negative and emotionally painful parts of people's missions, because there's a narrative that it is the best 2 years, and that there's a lot of shame around if you didn't have a beautiful, only a beautiful, loving experience. that there's not a lot of room in our culture to process this. And so I've found through not only my fellow companions and other missionaries, returned missionaries, but even people in their 50s, 60s, older, that have never been able to talk about these issues. And my hope for the generations coming forth, and I think it's just happening naturally, is that the awareness around the mental health issues of just prepping missionaries and the messaging we send in the cultures of the missionary system is more carefully thought through. And I think it's happening naturally because the spectrum of Mormonism is widening. And as in my mission, some missionaries thrived because developmentally it was appropriate for them. They never had structure. And so when they get in this structured system, that was what was their edge. That was what really helped them. For me, I was already high strung and following the rules, and it fostered scrupulosity and unhealthy things. So as we pay attention to more the spectrum of Mormonism and just the way each individually are at different places, I think we can create a more healthy system for thriving. But that's just a little bit of about my experience, and I know, I realize it's only my experience, and there's multitudes of experiences, but hopefully that gives a glimpse of just some of the shadows and lights that are that come with the gospel, the church experience, and things that we can do to really make it better for those that are coming after us.
Thank you so much. While Gloria was speaking, I remembered that I had this slide of her interview. These are a couple excerpts of the interview. And one of the things that struck me was that she used the word broken several times in reference to her mission, that it broke this identity that she had built up, and something better actually emerged, something more honest. But and I think you're absolutely right, because even though I feature Gloria in this chapter pretty heavily, I do so because her experiences turned out in so many other interviews when people were reflecting on their missions, who had served them. And so for some people, the mission was transformative. It was important. I didn't hear a single person say that it was the best 2 years of their life. And so that narrative is a powerful one, but perhaps even more powerful because it does not seem to be typical. As we saw, statistically, most people look back on their mission positively and believe that it helped them to grow. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't a painful growth, that leading edge of pain.
Can I add something real quick? And the question that I would like to hold with all of you is, how can we have transformation without unnecessary suffering? Like, I know it's sometimes people think of it like an army experience, like you just have to grit through it and it'll make you stronger. But do we really have to suffer to transform to that extent? And the last thing I'll add is that in terms of the light, I think I touched more on the shadow, is that if I had kids and they wanted to go on a mission, I wouldn't steer them away, partly because it is a beautiful thing to, at that age, developmentally, when you're so identified with your friends and your music and your appearance, and to strip all the things that you're naturally identified with so strongly and have this strong intention to give it all up for some higher cause, it did grow you up in a way that you probably wouldn't have done like for years on. And so there is a maturation that happens that is really special. but notwithstanding the toxic cultures that come with it too.
Do you ever have a dream where you are called to serve a mission and do you get that nightmare at all?
I've never had that.
You have not had the dream. Has anybody here had that dream? Oh, that's interesting. So that came up several times in interviews. People who say that they have had a dream. One interviewee told me that, and this is someone who had left the church since then, but he said that in the dream, he's married and he has children, but he still says yes to going on a mission, even though he knows that it would be the bad thing for his family. It's very interesting how that has formed in his psyche. So Annabelle Jensen, her story is featured in the gender chapter of the book. I'm going to give a couple of slides from that chapter about some of the differences in Mormonism between women and men. I've shared before that I tend to get very frustrated when I'm sitting in church and someone talks about how naturally spiritual women are and how women are angels and women are fabulous and, you know, like, can we quantify that a little bit? So I quantified it, right? And theologically, on 14 different questions of belief, Mormon women were 9 points more religious, more religiously orthodox. So now we have it, right? We're not on a pedestal, but we're 9 points more orthodox. Women also have higher church attendance. 61% of currently identified Mormon women said they'd been to church in the last 30 days, and 52% of men. But Annabelle's story is not talking about religious orthodoxy, although in our interview we did talk about that, and Annabelle came across as being very theologically orthodox, thinking about prayer, about the Book of Mormon, which she called a numinous document. I thought I was very struck by that language, that she experiences the numinous within the Book of Mormon. I have a section about the Proclamation on the Family, and in our interview, Annabelle testified to me of the truth of the Proclamation on the Family and said, I agree with the proclamation that gender is eternal because for me, I am a woman and I always will be a woman. I'm just in the wrong body. I have to tell you two things. The first is that I have never in whatever, the 23 years since the Proclamation on the Family was issued, had a more positive swelling in my soul that maybe it actually is true than when Annabelle was talking about it. Maybe gender is eternal, I was thinking. And then the second thing I was thinking is, I have got to stop crying in this interview. I don't know if you remember this, but I was trying very hard to control my emotions. And Annabelle's story is intermingled with transitioning from being a man to being a woman, but it's also very touched by her diagnosis, which I'm sure she's going to talk about. And it was really tough for me to remain professional in the context of this interview. I wanted to read one more quote from her that didn't make it into the book, but I think is really powerful. I asked, how does knowing you have cancer affect your feelings about gender? How do you regard your decision to start living authentically as a woman? And she said, I'm grateful for all the choices I've made, the transition, all the things. I have some regrets, but right now, I'm a person who likes to live in the now. Maybe that's a side effect of not having a future to live in, but for me, it's always been the now, and right now, I am happy. That's the greatest thing I can advise anyone. Live happy. My favorite scripture says, God is that men might be, and men are that they might have joy. And to me, joy isn't just happiness. It isn't just laughing. It's something deep inside. It's a light that shines to everyone around you, even when you are in the depths of despair. If you have that joy, it's always there, always affecting the people around you. And I try to live my life to always have that joy, that pure, undistilled joy that touches hearts and changes minds. That's what I tried to do before cancer, and that's what I'm going to be doing all the way up until cancer flatlines me every last moment I can.
Well, now I'm probably going to cry. I don't know how to follow that. Okay, so I do want to thank Jana for allowing me to be part of this project. Oh, closer. Ah, there we go. Okay, but yeah, I do want to thank Jana for allowing me to be part of this project. As has been said, you know, I have terminal brain cancer, and so I don't have many opportunities to share my story anymore. I don't have the strength, and it means a lot to me that this book is going to be there to be able to share my story long after I'm dead. And so I'm happy to be able to share it with you here in person and share more that's going to be in the book, or that won't be in the book, rather. And because of the brain cancer, I have a tendency to ramble or slightly go off topic. So if that happens, I apologize. Just bear with me. So I guess, good grief. I used to do panels all the time, and suddenly I'm completely lost. Wow. I'm sorry. Transitioning. Okay. So, I'll just tell the story. So I started realizing that I was different when I was like 8 years old. I had no idea what was going on, but I felt like I wanted to be like my sister. I wanted to wear the dresses and stuff, but I didn't have words to go with that. There's no fancy word like transgender when you're 8 years old, at least not when you're a millennial and growing up in the 90s. It's just not happening. And as time went on, you know, a couple of years later, 10, 11, I realized, oh, the thought that goes with this is I want to be a girl. And that scared the living daylights out of me, because I had seen my family laugh at movies like What a Girl Wants and or What a Woman Wants, whatever, and Mrs. Doubtfire, where there's guys dressing up as women, and I didn't want to be laughed at. And then I remember there was a newscast one morning when we were getting ready for school, and there was a story about a woman in a state somewhere that had been a trans woman that had been elected mayor of this town. And my mom just goes, oh, that's so gross. And I'm like, oh no, I cannot say anything ever about this. I was terrified because I didn't want to be the gross one. I didn't want to be not liked in my family. And so I kept it inside. I went through, I got the priesthood. I was in the quorum presidencies all the way growing up, teachers, deacons, priests. I was in the presidencies the whole way. I read my scriptures, I prayed every day, and just trying to, you know, you hear the phrase, pray the gay away. I was trying to pray the trans away, but it doesn't have the same ring to it, but hey, yeah, but that's what I was doing. I was trying to ask God to take it away from me. And it never happened, and it never happened. And the feelings only got stronger, and it got harder and harder to fight. And there came a point where, you know, I'm 18. I have to decide, okay, am I going on a mission? And that was kind of the do or die moment. It's like, okay, if I go on a mission, I'm going to have to be absolutely a guy and be okay using the priesthood and doing all these things. And I didn't know. And so I went to God. I went to prayer and just bore my soul out. And I finally got an answer after 8, 10 years of praying, and I just heard very clearly, you are okay the way you are. And, you know, that can be taken a lot of ways, but the feeling that came with it defined it, and that was that it was okay that I wanted to be a girl because that was who I was on the inside. And so I decided not to go on a mission. It wasn't right for me because, you know, at this point I support women who want to have the priesthood, but at the time it wasn't very well looked upon, so I didn't want to have to use the priesthood. I didn't feel like it was right for me. And I ended up, I guess, leaving the church for a little while, or going inactive. I didn't attend church for 6 years or so. And in that time frame, I grew as a person. I learned about life out in the world, I guess, away from the little Mormon bubble. And when after I started transition, you know, dressing full-time as female, this was in 2014, so that was like 5 years after I had made my realization that it was okay for me to be a girl. At that point, I had at that point, I was starting to want to be more myself, and that's why I was doing the transition, why I was becoming a woman, is to be more myself and to feel more right in body and soul. And once I started that process, especially when I started hormones, I realized there was something missing from my life. And after a little bit of soul searching, I realized, oh, you haven't been to church in 6 years. Maybe that's what you should do. And so I went, and I realized, yeah, that's what's missing. You know, I learned in my time away from the church that I needed it in my life. You know, it's not 100% good for me because, you know, you still get people who look down on trans folk. But I could be there for the spirituality of it, for me, not for anyone else, for me and for God. And, you know, I was scared my first time going in, and I'm like, I go up to the bishop after sacrament meeting, say, hey, can we talk? He goes, yeah, sure. And I go, okay, well, so I'm transgender. Is it okay if I'm here? And he's like, yeah, that's fine. You know, you can't really do a lot of stuff, but it's okay. We're happy to have you. And, you know, that's kind of how it went. I went to that ward for a year, and then started at my current ward after I moved. And that's where I felt the most acceptance in the church I've ever had, even from when I was a kid. And I went into that ward, did the same thing, went to sacrament meeting and went up to the bishop afterwards, said, hey, can we talk? And he goes, yeah, sure. So we go in, I go, hey, I'm transgender. Bishop goes, I don't know what that is, but okay, welcome. And so he goes, okay, so I don't know what that is. Let me call in the Relief Society president. And so she comes in, she goes, okay, what's up? I go, well, I'm transgender. And the Relief Society president works with LDS Family Services as a therapist. And she comes in and goes, what's up? I say, well, I'm transgender. She goes, wonderful. Do you want to be a visiting teacher? And that's been symbolic of my experience for the past 4 years with this ward. They have shown me nothing but the Christ-like love that we should all feel in the church. And they've helped me to build my testimony. I mean, it's still small. I don't know everything. I don't have this big, booming testimony that you can preach from the top of a mountain, but it's there, which I never had as a child, and all the years as a guy trying to grow up. And, you know, a year after moving into that ward, as has been said, we found out I had terminal brain cancer, which changed a lot of priorities for me. I had been planning on going into psychology therapy to be able to help other transgender people, because there's a lot of us out there who are in religion who are being rejected by that religion or the parents in that religion. And that was not okay. And I wanted to be able to be there to help talk people through it. And the cancer kind of took that away from me. I still try to help when I can, but when it's hard to move or hard to think, it gets really difficult. And I don't know. Sometimes I feel like this goal of mine to be able to help people is a bit of a fail, because there's only one group of people that I haven't been able to really help understand this issue, and that's my family. My family rejects me outright. And I've tried to show them love. I've tried to explain it to them, but they won't listen to it, and they quote things like the proclamation to the family at me, or other scriptures that say that I'm doing this wrong. And I keep trying to live my life. Even in spite of that, I keep trying to live the truth. I keep trying to live the gospel. And I hope I can be an example for people. Hopefully for them someday. But until then, everyone else, maybe. Yeah. I think that's most of my story. Is there anything else you want me to add? Okay.
Just wanted to make sure I didn't have any more dedicated slides. I learned some interesting things that I didn't know in the course of researching what it means to be transgender within the church. Annabelle and also another transgender interviewee pointed out to me that in the LDS handbook, there is really very little about transgender. And essentially it says you cannot have surgery, and yeah, I'd have to go back to see the original. Yeah, please, go ahead.
Okay. So in the handbook, in the bishop's handbook, it says that it says very little about transgender issues. It says, okay, you can't hold a calling, you can't. I mean, that's like the primary thing is you can't hold a calling. And if you have surgery, then you run the very likely risk of getting excommunicated. But that's all it says. And it's more a matter of policy instead of doctrine, because they've straight up said that they don't know anything really about transgender issues, and they keep saying they're trying to study it, but we never seeing anything about it.
So there is a bit of a gray area at this point in in the official handbook, and I was particularly touched by the story of how your new ward has embraced you. In the interview, she mentions that, you know, they have been loving her through this cancer and helping with a lot of the things that in the absence of family, she's needed. And that moved me tremendously. I'd like to open it up for questions about either of these issues, for Gloria, for Annabelle, for me. And also, like I said, we have slides on some other things with the research if you're interested in that.
I wanted to thank you, too, for your vulnerability. And Annabelle, you're not wrong. We're wrong. The church is wrong. So thank you very much for sharing your story. So my question ends up being is, will the website be hosting the full transcripts of the interviews that weren't able to make it into the book? And would those be available? Because I think that would be a wonderful thing to have for members and for us as a body to see how we can be more of a body of Christ in loving all of our fellow men.
Well, after you frame it that way, I feel like a total heel in saying no. Because in conducting interviews, you have to get permission from the interviewees for the limited thing that you are doing. And I did not ask permission to make these interviews available to the public. I only asked permission to have them quoted or excerpted in a book using only the first name, you know, there to have the option of remaining anonymous. That is a beautiful idea. But there will be a website for the book, like I said, and eventually the actual data set will be up there, probably a year after the book or a year and a half after the book is published, so that other researchers can come and comb the data. There is so much in this data that we did not get to analyze. So if you are a social science graduate student and you're looking for a thesis, you know, something to do, come talk to me. We've got a lot of data.
If you could summarize an overarching theme, I guess like a takeaway, what would that be in terms of where are millennials taking the church?
Well, okay, I'm going to show a slide for that one. Okay, let's take a look at this one. So this is looking at general social survey data longitudinally from 1973 to 2016. And this looks at retention. As you can see, people in the generation born before 1943, we were retaining 3/4 and almost that many among the boomers. For Gen Xers, it declines to 62.5%. So on behalf of all Gen Xers, we're really sorry that we started this. And millennials, according to the GSS, we're only retaining 46%. For Pew data, Pew data has the millennial retention rate at 62%. So that's a little bit higher, a little bit more optimistic. What we've been saying in summary is that Mormonism used to keep 3/4 of its adherents. I think we're on very solid footing saying that, and we are now keeping about half. So in answer to your question about how millennials are changing the church, well, I think there's a lot of hand-wringing on the part of church leaders about statistics like these and about the number of people who are leaving. So that in itself is a catalyst for change, perhaps, from church leaders. But millennials who are still in the church, I think it would be wonderful if they were given more latitude to innovate and be creators of change. Gloria and Thomas and I were just talking about this before this session, but there's a kind of culture of hierarchy and control in the church, kind of, you know, just a little bit, which makes that hard. So Oxford in titling this book, you know, I had titled it The Next Mormons, and we'd already reserved the Next Mormons website domain name, right? So we couldn't change the title, but they changed the subtitle, which is now different from what was in the program. It's now How Millennials Are Changing the LDS Church. And I wrote back and said, well, you know, that's a nice subtitle, but it remains to be seen how millennials will change the LDS Church. That's a live question, and whether they will really be allowed to change the LDS Church. But they went ahead with it, and they like active verbs in subtitles, apparently. So, great. Now, millennials, you have to go and change the church so that the subtitle comes true.
Annabelle, could you tell us about your family? Was it in an urban or a rural setting? And if whatever it was, did that have an effect, do you think, upon the attitude of your family?
Well, it was suburbs area, just, I don't really know how to describe it other than that, just, but it was, I really don't know what had an effect on my family. I really don't. Primarily because I was raised with this concept of treat everyone with love and kindness and respect. And when my parents started showing something opposite of that, acting opposite of that, it actually took me very much by surprise. I didn't understand how they could reject what they had taught me all growing up. So I don't really know how else to answer that.
Hi, Jenna. I've heard from you and others that there is leadership concern about the millennial retention rate, but I feel like sometimes it's harder for us who aren't social scientists to see that. And I was wondering if you could speak to either evidence or ratios of leadership awareness or concern and what you think that might produce.
Great question. I can speak about that on the local level. A lot of bishops and stake presidents, even some mission presidents, some seminary and institute teachers have contacted me already about this research. It's been really fascinating to write a book that people hear about through the grapevine a year before it's published. I mean, that doesn't happen, but there's a lot of worry about this. And I think that if change happens, that's how it will happen. It will happen on the local level. In fact, last year I was speaking in Colorado about some of this research, and particularly about women and gender. And one of the things that I pointed out to them is that for women, the top reason for leaving the church is to say you felt judged or misunderstood. And that weekend, there was an email that went out in their ward that in the ward of some of the women that I was working with, that there was concern that the young women in this ward were dressing immodestly, you know, little tartlets, and we've got a crackdown on how they're dressing. And someone who'd been at the conference said, you know what? Let's not go there. Let's not dwell on this. Let's focus on loving them. And so in that tiny way, in one ward, the research made a difference. They were able to say, we don't want to alienate young people. We want to communicate to them that we're glad they're there at all, and we're grateful for them. As far as the brethren, I think you're also maybe asking about that. I am aware that the executive summary of this research was passed on to one member of the Quorum of the Twelve. I don't know if it was read. I don't know if anything else happened about it. But that can't be my concern. You know, I'm a researcher, and I am thrilled to do this project in order to educate, but I can't approach it from a perspective of advocacy, or else I would go crazy. Right? Yeah. It's a descriptive project. It's not necessarily prescriptive, and how people interpret it and use it will be up to them.
Hi, thanks to all of you for the great comments. I'm just curious, in my former life, I was a hospice volunteer. I'm just wondering, are you getting support from hospice and all of that? Maybe that'd be a little bit too personal, but just wondering. Hospice, are you getting support from hospice, either in the church or outside the church?
So I'm actually not on hospice. I'm actually, my cancer right now is stable. It's been stable for a year and a half. I am regularly seeing a palliative care team.
Okay, good. Forgive me if that was a little bit too personal. One of the greatest experiences I ever had in my life was as a hospice volunteer, and one of my best experiences was with a young man, a young guy who had glioblastoma. I don't know if that's your pathology.
Yep, GBM.
I assume that's your pathology, yeah. And so that was just a great experience. So if you haven't connected with hospice, I hope you can. It was great for everybody. So,
yeah, anyway. Well, when I reach that point, I probably will. Yeah. I would like to speak to that just a little bit more. When I went into the hospital for this, I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. And, you know, being trans, I grow a beard. And that's uncomfortable. I'll just say that. And the people in the hospital, the workers there, treated me with such kindness and respect. They came in and helped me shave every few days just to help keep me from going crazy and being depressed about it. And they didn't cause any issues. They were actually very curious and were asking questions. So, I mean, the healthcare is amazing from my experience. And so, yeah.
The other comment would be, I'm Hiram Smith's great-great-great-grandson, and so grew up in a family that was very, very, very devout. I served a mission in 1973 to 75 in Taiwan, and ended up going back on a foreign exchange scholarship, and I met my wife, and I've had a 40-year successful business career in the Far East. 10 years ago, I basically, for lots and lots of reasons, I became a social and cultural member. I'm no longer a believing member. Just one other thought might be that I'm now a student at Harvard studying East Asian theology that's intersected by Mormonism and working with David Holland, who is my academic advisor. but a thought is that stepping away, be a cultural Mormon and don't get tied up with all the toxic theology and dogma. That's another way to go. I've never been happier, to be honest, as a cultural member and participating that way and not worrying about the dogma.
Two things. First, your statistic here concerning the millennial retention. I'm sure that's very accurate because I attended a Book of Mormon conference recently in Ogden, and a presenter said that in Utah County there are 80,000 returned missionaries and 40% of them are inactive after 2 or 3 years. So it's very serious. The millennials are leaving the church. I have a friend in the missionary department of the church, or excuse me, the membership department. She told me that in 1917, 60,000 people removed their names from the records of the church.
You mean 2017?
Yeah, excuse me, 2017. Thank you. Now, sister, your story is so touching. What I find interesting is that your ward gave you a position of visiting teacher, was it?
They talked about it. It didn't actually...
Oh, it didn't come about.
It didn't, but they were... And that was mostly because of my health. And
okay.
But they were willing to give
it. But they were willing.
Yeah.
Yet that would have contradicted the bishop's handbook, right?
I don't think being a visiting teacher actually would have. I think, right, it's an assignment. Okay. So it could have, sexism could work in its favor, right?
I was just wondering why people were so Christian in your ward, they aren't in a lot of others.
Yeah, I haven't experienced the dream of receiving a mission call again after having returned back. I did have a dream as a missionary that I was proselyting, which I remember waking up in despair that I couldn't escape even in my sleep. I was curious, Jana, if you might tell me What do you see as some potentially plausible changes that could happen in the church that might make it more appealing to millennials?
I think this would be good for everyone to weigh in on. Changes that would happen in the church to make it more appealing to millennials. Let me preface this by saying that we are living in a time of rapid and widespread disaffiliation from religion in the American religious landscape. This is not unique to Mormonism. And in Mormonism, we tend to have tunnel vision. We imagine that our glorious theology and everything is totally wonderful and unique, and we forget about the rest of the world and what they have to offer. But we also imagine that our problems are unique in a way that is, I find, puzzling. Our problems are not unique. In fact, we're actually doing better than a lot of religions in America. So I want to preface this question about what can be done by saying that some things can be done and should be done, but in terms of fixating on particular outcomes of thinking that we're going to stem this tide in a really big way, I don't think it's going to happen. Just because of what's going on all around us. Religion does not exist in an island. However, that doesn't mean I don't have a list, right? Boy, have I got a list. And the very first number one thing I would love to see is more listening of adults, older adults to young adults. We just don't do that. We tell young adults what to do. We send them off on missions. We mobilize them beautifully to do things like indexing names of the dead. But we're not listening to what they want without judging or without instructing. And we don't have any systems in place in our church for reverse mentoring. We don't have any systems in place for young people advising old people. I imagine that at church headquarters sometime there's going to be, you know, a 93-year-old prophet saying, hey, can you help me with my computer? Other than that, I really don't think that there's a lot of heavy-duty listening to young adults going on, so everything needs to start there. And I also think we need to have more freedom at the local level. One of the fascinating things that emerged from this research was in the authority chapter, where we have one data point after another about how distance young adults feel from church hierarchy in terms of questions of if your views came into conflict with that of a priesthood holder, would you privilege your own experience or just obey even if you thought it was wrong? You know, compared to older Mormons, they are not interested in the doings of the institutional church. They're not watching General Conference by a 34-point drop from the silent generation. But the silver lining is that they also report having the closest relationships with their local bishops of any generation. So if this is going to happen, it needs to start at the local level, and it has to come from them and not then be co-opted where one ward does something successful and then everyone else says, ooh, let's take that and let's cookie cutter it and make it go everywhere, which is the death knell. This is a generation, this is a farm-to-table generation. This is a generation where authenticity is very important. And that old modernist paradigm of having something be the same everywhere being a virtue, that is not a virtue. It's a liability now. So beginning to think of loosening the centralization and focusing on the local level and allowing young people to take the lead is really what we need to do.
One thing I'll add is that I think the generation is just born into a more socially connected and information-heavy world. And so by nature, I was really inspired by Greg Prince's vision of having not only social justice issues be something we claim and are more authority of. People are really attracted to that in our generation, and we're very awake to the injustices that are going around. And so if we want to be relevant to this generation, we have to engage in issues that are important to our generation. Also, community is really important to this generation. Having grown up in institutions that we aren't as loyal loyal to, and our sense of belonging being more fractured by being more mobile in general, we're looking for community. And so how do we foster community not by duty, but by just genuine, authentic relationships? Those are some creative questions that we can ask ourselves to feed and nourish this generation, speaking for myself too.
I never feel like I'm getting close enough to this. I would generally echo everything that's been said here. But I would like to add that in order to, I guess, make changes, our leaders need to be willing to listen and adapt, you know, learn about the issues. When I was telling my story, my bishop said, I don't know what transgender is, and eventually ended up learning about it. And actually, he didn't study a lot, from my understanding, but he studied enough to realize that it was okay that I was there. And I think that's something that a lot of our leaders need to do, from, you know, bishop all the way on up to the first presidency, is actually look at these things and approach them from an angle of compassion and openness and welcoming.
You know, one other thing that I forgot to mention is politics. There is a pretty direct line in the data, not just in ours, but also what's coming out of PRRI, of young people being turned off by conservative politics. And that is very true among the former Mormon population that we see. So, yeah, not counting the traditional family. You know, when we asked Mormons to name their top political issue, or political or social issue facing the nation, for the boomer silent generation combined, it was changing notions of the traditional family. That was their primary issue. And for millennials, it was poverty and homelessness. Isn't that interesting? I think that should tell us something about the priorities that you were talking about. Having a global perspective is very important. Yeah.
Actually, that was going to be my first comment on that, answering that question. For me, I always say a little less Reagan, a little more Jesus. And it's from those same studies I'm kind of getting that vibe. Dare I say a little less Trump, a little more Jesus. But my question, I'm really interested in the data. It seems to me, and I'm just kind of new to all of this. This is my first Sunstone. Yay, I'm stoked.
Welcome.
I participate pretty heavily online, the Mormon Millennials page, and a few others. But and so looking at faith journeys, and apparently I need to pick up your book. But in my experience, it seems like millennials seem to be transitioning quicker through these stages. And I'm trying to figure out why. And your data seems to echo that. And some of them are, you know, as they go through the stages, staying. Some of them are a lot are going. The information about the missions, I'm wondering if the data shows, or if you can speak to a relationship between the higher rates of serving a mission and the higher rate. To me, the mission pushes people into that pressure cooker situation for many. I had a blast on my mission. I'm here with one of my companions, actually. It was a different kind of mission, though. Dominican Republic. Good stuff. Anyways, previously, I'd always looked at access to information as kind of the biggest one. The internet. Me growing up, it was don't look at anything controversial. Don't Google Mormonism because you'll find stuff you don't want to read, right? It wasn't until much later now that the church is starting to go, oh, well, we can't just brush stuff under the rug. And so access to information being one, but I think maybe there might be something with this higher rates of serving a mission and bumping up against these, you know, stage three Fowler, stage three claims, and then your life experience is going, wait, this isn't what I've been taught. I wonder if you have any.
Well, I love the theory, actually, and this it has happened to me many times in the data where I have a narrative crafted in my head and it makes a lot of sense, and then the data just blows it out of the water. Because actually, and this speaks to an earlier comment as well, what we found is that for returned missionaries who served their entire mission, who did not return home early, only 1 in 9 have left the church. Okay. Isn't that interesting? So serving a mission, serving the entire time, actually seems to have a bit of a protective correlation okay. to staying.
Well, there went that theory.
Well, I know, but believe me,
well, I love it.
Many, many times when I came with particular theories, for example, the early return, I thought, well, that makes sense because we lowered the missionary age and people are going out before they're ready. They're going out when they're 18. I have a 19-year-old and, you know, no way, right? That's not the case, though, because when I broke down that generation in half to older millennials and younger millennials, it was already starting with the older millennials, and in fact it's rebounded just a little bit with the younger ones. So sometimes, you know, we have wonderful things that make sense to us, and then unfortunately, darn it, the numbers stubbornly don't back us up.
No, that's why you asked the questions. Thank you.
I was just going to ask, through with all your data, I mean, you obviously go in kind of understanding a lot of the issues that are driving generally what are kind of driving people out of the church or driving the way people are thinking. Was there anything that just really surprised you that you kind of were either weren't prepared for, or you just didn't see coming at all in your data?
About why people leave?
Just in general, like what with millennials or with like why people are leaving or anything like that. Like, was there just like some stuff that you just were not expecting to see in any of the data?
Lots of things were surprising to me, truly. There were so many things. As far as why people leave and surprises there, one was the issue of being judged or misunderstood. I was really interested to see that was so high for women. It was also tied for first, I believe, with millennials. And it's not as much of an issue for men or for older men in particular. So it's worth asking why. I had a man say something to me about this, and he said, well, what is it about women that they feel judged all the time? Yeah, just sit with that for a minute. Yeah. But yes, there were many, many surprises in the data, and I try in the book to, I do speak about it in the first person at times and say, here's what I was expecting to find, and actually here's what we found in the numbers. Here's another example, and I did blog about this recently, so this may not be news to you, but we just celebrated the 40th anniversary of the priesthood temple ban being lifted, and African-American respondents actually had a higher rate of approving the priesthood temple ban as having been God's will than white Mormons. I found that very surprising. Mormons of color altogether also had higher rates of saying that the nation's increasing racial diversity was not a positive trend for the future, which I found extremely surprising. When I did more digging about that, actually, that is not an isolated finding from our survey. In fact, another national survey, not just of Mormons, found that African Americans had a more negative view of racial diversity in the future than white respondents. So that should be an interesting cause for reflection. Why is that the case? Comments?
Yes, so on your chart, we would be boomers. We have the original Sunstone magazine and everyone since then lined up on shelves in a spare bedroom. So, but we think, or I'm speaking for myself, I think more like a millennial, but I don't have the computer skills of a millennial. So, the being divided into these different groups, I mean, it's a little tough to see a chart like this. Our own children are in these second two groups, and it's... We as far as the church goes, three of our daughters have not remained in the church and their families. And the issues were, they were not necessarily, they've learned a lot of the historical issues, which we've been aware of for years, and so probably they have been somewhat aware of. But their issues right now, the policy, mm-hmm. It was just, I thought that would slay me. I didn't know if I could go on after that. But then I was given a wonderful calling. The enrichment leader in Relief Society, it's so open, I can do whatever seems necessary. So we are aware of the things that they couldn't handle, that were too much. And I think it's different for different people, but a lot of their friends in the church also are not remaining. I can see how it doesn't appeal to them in so many ways. But we've decided a new definition for the perfect family. Because maybe it really doesn't exist, and maybe the perfect family is a family with all kinds of people with all kinds of views who love each other.
Amen. Just as a quick response to that, you know, I live in Cincinnati where one of your daughters was going through this, and we know each other, and so I watched that happen, and we, it's our loss. It is the church's loss. But that reverberation of the 2015 policy came up again and again in interviews. Statistically, most Mormons who are still in the church approve of the policy. But it's very interesting, yeah, it's very interesting to look at that data compared to these other questions about their belief, because Mormons who are in the church tend to strongly agree whenever they're given the opportunity to strongly agree with the church. And the agreement was more tepid. It was there, but it was, especially among millennials, I somewhat agree. They don't want to come out directly and oppose the policy or oppose the prophet, but they are not thrilled.
So as a millennial Mormon who is active but has found a sort of nuanced way of doing that, I'm wondering if there's some optimism to be found in these numbers. I'm wondering if you have data on the happiness levels of each generation, because some part of me wonders if millennials have given themselves more permission to do what they want than previous generations have had, like perhaps with your coffee drinking, where millennials feel like maybe they can stay and have coffee once a month and still consider themselves active or whatever. Is it possible that even if they're leaving the institution, they still may find positive spirituality in their life that may be or may not be rooted in the church? Does that make sense? Because sometimes I wonder if earlier generations didn't have that option, maybe, and we, in our girl power and our sort of entitlement, have given ourselves the permission to do so. Do you have any information on that?
Not about happiness levels. That would have been a good question. The only happiness question we asked was about marital happiness of the people who are married. Here's something interesting. Former Mormon married people were just slightly more happy with one another than currently married people. How about you guys? What do you think about this question about millennials perhaps feeling more free to define themselves?
This is purely my opinion, obviously, but I think there's definitely a strong flavor of individuality and agency and kind of a freedom from institutional loyalty that's in our generation. However, I don't equate that with like necessarily being happier, because there seems to be, in not only our generation, but in these times, maybe an existential crisis of meaning making and things that used to give us identity and belonging and a worldview and structure. Those are being deconstructed in like a postmodern time. So that might be more destabilizing, not to say it's good or bad or whatever, but I don't know. I can't say we are happier that way. Yeah.
And again, this is my opinion, but I feel like I feel like we can be happier, mostly because, you know, we aren't restricted to those little rules and nitpicky things that, honestly, it goes back to follow the letter of the law or the spirit of the law. And I feel like if we're following the spirit rather than the letter, we're going to be a lot happier when it comes down to it. And I think a lot of us find that when we're following the spirit of the law, we actually end up with more freedom to do different things and to experience different things. And that diversity is what makes us strong as individuals and strong as a people.
I think that's a great place to close right there. I want to thank both Annabelle and Gloria for sharing your stories, your willingness to do that for the book, and also for everyone here today. And thank you all for coming and bringing such great questions.